both papers by Pete Belki and Dan Smith are really stimulating. And the papers bear evidence that one cannot have a high hope on politicians and bureaucrats for better achievement and especially for better monetary policy. A strong argument of the paper is to point out the conflict between what is considered as technically optimal in monetary policy with what is politically optimal. If of course some technically optimal solution does exist on the blackboard on the or the paperboard. In our contemporary democracies, we can no more elaborate economic theories on optimal monetary policy or optimal fiscal policy while leaning on the dominant orthodoxy of benevolent and omniscient politicians, or leaning on the mythology of faceless bureaucrats, all of them mainly motivated to forward the public interest. Today, 50 years after the publication of the Calculus of Consent by Buchanan and Gordon Tullock, we can no more ignore the insights of the public choice discipline. And for many reasons, it is really a fascinating and attractive idea from Butke and Dan Smith to have put together three major authors, respectively Friedrich Hayek, Milton Friedman, and James Buchanan. And as it is shown in the paper, in the papers, these contemporary classical liberal authors, each one on his own way, came to reject the possibility that monetary authorities are able to shield themselves from political influences. And there is also a great humility from them, because not only they have rejected such idea, but also they have turned themselves to still realistically toward what is really politically possible. And leaning on the works of these three prestigious authors, Pete Butke and Dan Smith conclude by claiming for applied to our monetary institutions professional humility, creative thinking, and really what is political possible and not politically feasible today. Well, as I am fully in sympathy with the bulk of the paper, first I would like to add some points in the same way. Economists are used today to say that monetary policy is partly an art and partly a science issue. This is what we read in the macroeconomics textbook generally. And today, monetary policy is viewed as an art because it has frequently to face new, unexpected, and misunderstood events. Each one event should be swiftly analyzed in order to make decisions which are not founded on outcomes of the academic research, but really on some kind of intuition fed by strong experience. And as an example, oftenly Alan Greenspan was presented as the archetype of an expert in his field. On the other hand, as regards economics, one should admit that there has been some kind of progress since the period when money, that is monetary policy, did not matter. And to the more recent period with the insights of rational expectation theory and the new classical macroeconomics. Thus, turning central bankers' attention to rules rather discretion. This, in my view, is a kind of progress. Now, correspondingly, actually, there has been a remarkable trend toward increasing independence of central banks throughout the world. Yet, the authors are fully right when they ask the question, look, how much, in fact, central banks are independent? And the authors show that the Fed is not free from political pressures and from the public support for the actions of the Federal Reserve. It plays an important role. In January 1999 was created the ECB together with the European System of Central Banks, the Maastricht Treaty made this system the most one of the most independent central banks in the world. Actually, the mandates of the Fed and the ECB and the ESCB, respectively, are not very different. Both have objectives of price stability, high level of employment, and sustainable economic growth. Their mandates are not very different if high level of employment is defined as the natural rate of employment, which is today accepted even by the new Keynesianism. And as for price stability, as it was shown, for instance, by Thomas Sturgeon and Neil Wallace, there is some unpleasant monetary arithmetics. That is to say, if there is permissive fiscal policy, in the end, it will be necessary to stabilize the public debt through the inflation tax. Another point is how to achieve price stability. To that end, policymakers may adopt two strategies, either monetary targeting or inflation targeting. And one should notice that monetary targeting, when it was applied during a relatively short period, was quite different from Milton Friedman's suggestion that the chosen monetary aggregate be targeted to grow at a constant rate. Even in Germany, actually, the monetary targeting regime was not so strict in practice. It was rather flexible, so that the target ranges really were missed about 50% of the time because of the Bundesbank's concern with growth, with output growth, and with exchange rates. And eventually, most of the countries, since the 90s, adopted the other regime, that is inflation targeting. And it is crystal clear that inflation targeting contains a substantial degree of policy discretion and offers central bankers considerable scope to respond to output fluctuations through several devices. And supporting such a view, many empirical studies showed that monetary policy have influence on the economic activity in the short run, and many theoretical models were built by introducing various kinds of imperfections and rigidities in the so-called dynamic general equilibrium model framework, thus giving to monetary policy a scientific background and making monetary policy as an art converge with monetary policy as science. At regard such convergence, it is striking that an increasing number of experts in their field became central bankers after an academic career as professional economists. And being in office, they frequently do refer to the outcomes of research in monetary policy in order to warrant their behavior. Unfortunately, as Budke and Smith explain in the paper, it is perplexing that notwithstanding the public choice insights grounded on strong microeconomics, monetary economists are still assuming omniscience and benevolence on the part of monetary authorities. I had no time to inquire in the macroeconomic textbook. I had in hand only one textbook written by, you certainly know this textbook by Mishkin and Eakins. I like very much this textbook. Anyway, it's 675 pages, and there is approximately only less than one page about bureaucracy, less than one page, and the authors conclude, I quote, "The theory of bureaucratic behavior seems applicable to the Federal Reserve's actions, but we must recognize that this view of the Fed as being solely concerned with its own interest is too extreme. Maximizing one's welfare does not rule out altruism. The Fed is surely concerned that it conduct monetary policy in the public interest." And there are a few lines about the political business cycle. And yes, it is repeated by the authors that the Fed is really motivated only by the public interest. And this is really very strange, but because on the one hand, they agree to say that this is a very unclear concept, the public interest. Anyway, they claim that the Fed can pursue policies that are in the public interest. And as Budke and Dan Smith emphasize, Friedman, Buchanan, and Hayek, respectively and separately, turn toward finding institutions that would be immune from the deficiencies of the political decision-making process in our democratic setting. Every one of these authors claim an institutional change, and as just a remark, as all of them share in common the ideas that the market alternative works, and that the government alternative is inherently inferior to the market, they are often accused the academic environment, often, at least in France and in other countries, they are often accused of dogmatism. But my question is, where is really dogmatism? So, as Budke and Smith say, we need a political economy which is robust to real-world conditions and which recommends politically possible options and not just politically feasible options. Although I am in agreement with the purpose of the paper, I have some methodological hesitation, if not doubts, about the contents of a robust political economy. I would like to make three remarks. First remark, on methodology, there were strong disagreements among Friedman, Buchanan, and Hayek. As we know, the Austrian research program in economics has epistemological and methodological foundations which differ radically from mainstream theory. Opposite to Austrian economics, Friedman was a macroeconomist and not a microeconomist. He believed that you can ascertain cause and effects from aggregates and averages. Hayek wrote that one of the things he most regretted is not having criticized Milton Friedman's essays in positive economics, which appeared to him, I quote Hayek, quite a dangerous book. Conversely, Milton Friedman objected to the Austrian approach, largely on the grounds that it implies conversion rather than gradual conviction by the weight of empirical tests. Now, if we turn to James McKenna, he wrote in a book entitled Constitutional Economics, 1991, it was published by the IEA. I quote again James McKenna, to the Chicago-based group of scholars who talk about economic theory and politics, the ideas that I have traced out amount to little or nothing until they are tested. Their view is that empirical work is the be-all and the end-all of the discipline. As regards Buchanan's methodology, there seems to be some common grounds with Austrian economics. Buchanan calls upon methodological individualism and subjectivism, as Hayek did, and Buchanan and Hayek both call for, as the proper function of economists, institutional theory and institutional analysis. However, in his book entitled, what famous book of James Buchanan, What Should Economists Do? James Buchanan wrote, I quote, "For myself, I advance no claim that my own thinking has yet rid itself of the paradigm of neoclassical orthodoxy." Is Buchanan an Austrian? There is a famous paper from Chuck Berne with the same title, is Buchanan an Austrian? Personally, I don't think so. But, and this is for me fascinating in the paper of Bottke and Dan Smith, there is, it seems to me, a bridge which can be built between Buchanan and Hayek economic theories. I will come back to this kind of bridge. My second remark is that although classical liberal economists agree on the desirability of a monetary discipline, I would say, there is nevertheless a real discord among them about the desirable monetary constitution. There are advocates of the gold standard, defenders of the commodity, of a basket of commodity standard, proponents of a fiat standard with constitutional safeguard, and advocates of free banking with fractional reserves, others with 100% reserves, and so on, and so on. Although all of them, as classical liberals, would agree on the same fiscal constitution promoting budget equilibrium, for me this is very clear, it is, on the other hand, doubtful that they would agree on the same monetary constitution. Maybe it is strange, but it is my view. And James Buchanan, one should admit, did not defend really a precise monetary constitution. Through contract theory of the state, he put forward a rationale for a monetary constitution and showed in a direct way what Friedman recommended in desperation, I would say, and only in desperation. Yet by so doing, James Buchanan went one step upwards, I would say. To him,
the absence of an explicit monetary constitution is simply unacceptable. And in other words, to James Buchanan, we should first agree that a monetary constitution is necessary, that is to say, before exhausting our energies in debates over the precise content of this constitution. Now, if one looks at Hayek's Constitution of Liberty or Hayek's Law, Legislation and Liberty, even though there are differences between these Hayekian writings, Hayek, as a political philosopher, does not contemplate the Constitution with the same eyes as James Buchanan. Hayek applies his understanding of the evolutionary development of society to the legal institutions, and to him, the rationalistic approach to the law may well run counter to a free society. Hayek's ideal, as we know, is the rule of law, which requires that law safeguard fundamental rights and civil liberty. To be sure, we need a monetary discipline. Yet, if we follow Hayek's writings all along, eventually, and in accordance with his thought in Law, Legislation and Liberty, monetary discipline should be part and parcel of a self-ordering system. According to Hayek, private property rights and competition do perform the crucial economic function of facilitating the unfolding of the market process. In my opinion, we are facing three different views about what is politically feasible. And even though we may easily agree with Betke and Smith that the scientific profession should focus on what is politically possible, I am questioning myself about what should be the contents of a robust political economy. And this is my last remark. That we should deny unrealistic assumptions is a proposal that appears to be relevant in a scientific approach today. Yet, there is a methodological challenge, because the more we are dealing with realism, and the more we are dealing with complexity. And with, as we know, in his earlier works, Milton Friedman repeatedly stressed that simplicity and predictive adequacy should be used together in evaluating theories, while Hayek advocated at the same time that anything simple is wrong. The implication of Hayek's argument in economics and knowledge demolished the economics of positivists, demolished econometrics, and any attempt to create a macroeconomics. Milton Friedman was on the other side, in the other side of the frontier, within the macroeconomic sphere. Fortunately, in his Nobel lecture of June 1977, Milton Friedman, it was published in the JP, Friedman eventually said that from now on, he favored more realistic theories. In dealing with the relationship between employment, unemployment and inflation, he observed that some changes were brought about by the failure of earlier hypotheses to offer predictions that were consistent with the empirical evidence. And moreover, in this paper, in this article, this lecture, Milton Friedman praised in the same lecture the newer theories for, I quote, for their richness and for their ability to rationalize a far broader range of experience. And these theories are precisely the investigation by Buchanan and Gordon Tullock and others. However, in the same Nobel Prize lecture, Milton Friedman suggested that in science, the refutation of hypotheses is all we are required to do. And the demonstration of the is must necessarily lead to some consensus of the out, which is a view that is explicitly rejected by James Buchanan. And in his book, What Should Economists Do?, really, James Buchanan was against, expressed his view against Friedman's view. And Buchanan writes, "I think that the ultimate purpose of positive analysis, conceptual or empirical, must be that of modifying the environment for choices, which must be, in some basic sense, normatively informed." And further, he writes, "I think that we must become more normative in our efforts." In searching for a robust political economy, we are facing the hard epistemological issue of the nature of progress in science. And on that issue, as you know, there are various views which remain more or less conflictual ones. Without entering this field, let me say that personally I am rather prone to think that methodological pluralism has much to offer, in that it at least it ensures novelty and that criticism is not dogmatic. Accordingly, I am inclined to defend the Austrian Hayekian research program as a robust political economy as regards both what is politically feasible and what is politically possible, and especially in monetary issues. The main reason is that Hayek's approach, in contrast with Friedman's and Buchanan's theories, is an evolutionary approach. Hayek considers the market, as you know, as a becoming process brought about by the continuous pressure of human behavior in a change. And a general coordination emerges, if there is one, emerges as a result of a whole network of evolving exchanges, bargains, trades, agreements, contracts, and so on. And at each stage of this evolution toward such coordination, which is continuously on the move, there are gains to be made. It is today, central banking is outside the market process. It belongs to a managerial macroeconomic system and not to an entrepreneurial system. As a matter of fact, central banking involves the politicization of money and of monetary management through the monopolistic supply of money. Wealth redistribution is clearly a concern of the central banker as a manager sheltered from the profit and loss system. Notwithstanding, what I mean is that even within control, there is still an evolutionary process, even though many choices are excluded by governmental powers. Actually, we are not involved in a process which tries out all possibilities. Yet, even in the contemporary welfare states, there are some possibilities. For instance, the information revolution and new technologies could well provide in the near future a means to bypass the last barriers to opportunities for currency substitution, not only in the international arena, but also within the domestic currency markets themselves. Ingenious ideas emerging from new technologies can be led to conjecture more extensive choice in currency. Although such change is not around the corner, Alan Greenspan himself in 1997 argued in this way, I quote Alan Greenspan, "Brand names used for